Bonnie and Clyde, Beyonce and Jay-Z. There's nothing quite like a good old-fashioned power couple. And personally, I think it's about time that we add today's guests, Hannah and Magnus, to that list. Hannah Elliott is a car writer and critic currently writing for Bloomberg, where, full disclosure, we were co-workers for the better part of 2 years. Before that, though, she was at Forbes, where she wrote about cars, watches, travel, you know, basically all that fun stuff that we love over here at Hodinkee. She's a serious journalist who isn't afraid to be brutally honest when she needs to be, but she also brings genuine passion to a beat that sometimes is a little bit lacking in enthusiasm. Magnus Walker, on the other hand, approaches cars from an entirely different angle. After a successful career in the clothing world, Magnus has become the don of Porsche collecting, modifying, and, of course, driving. Through his North English accent, you can hear how excited he is as he rattles off chassis numbers and his favorite routes for driving particular cars. In some ways, he's a purist, and in other ways, he's an iconoclast. Sometimes, though, he's both at once. In our first ever two-for-one episode, I sat down with both Hannah and Magnus, and we were joined by Hodinkee founder Ben Clymer, too. We talked about the differences between approaching cars as a critic and an enthusiast, why Porsche cast such a heavy spell on auto lovers, and why what's really worth collecting is not just the physical things, but the memorable moments you spend with them. I'm your host, Stephen Pulverant, and this is Hodinkee Radio. This week's episode is brought to you by Baume & Mercier. Stay tuned later in the show for a look at the Clifton Baumatic Cosc, a high-tech chronometer that offers phenomenal value for money. You can also learn more at baume@mercier.com. All right. Thank you guys for being here. It's good to see you. Haven't seen you, Hannah, in a long time. And good to finally meet you in person, Magnus. It's
good to be here for the Manhattan Beard Convention.
Because we also have Ben here.
Yeah. Hey, everybody.
I guess Gray, our producer, who's off mic, is the only one without a beard.
That's like a starter beard, I think.
All right, you can take some of that hair from up top, move it down below.
That's a lot of hair. It's a good place to start.
Should we link to a photo of Gray's hair in the show notes? Yeah. Should we do that?
We probably should. Yeah.
Cool. Well, this is the first time I think we've had two guests on the show at once.
Oh,
double trouble.
Yeah. But it seems to make sense for you guys.
Yeah.
We're a package deal. Yeah. Two for one special.
At this point, yeah. It's pretty good.
Beardo and weirdo.
Beardo and weirdo.
Yeah, it's the going phrase.
That's the name of today's show, Beardo and Weirdo.
Well, you guys met through the car world, which is where you both work. But you work in the car world in kind of very different capacities. I thought maybe we could start, if you guys could each kind of give us a little bit of background about who you are, how you ended up in the car world, and then kind of how the two of you met.
Ladies first.
Okay, well, I'm a journalist. I came up with no car background whatsoever. I'm a journalist who happens to write about cars, is how I say it. Magnus is a true enthusiast. I'm someone who is in the car world for a living, for my career, and it's great. But I'm a journalist. I studied journalism at Baylor and came up at Forbes magazine, which is, I knew Ben way back in the
story.
Day when he was still a banker or just getting out of banking.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah. when I was working at Forbes writing about luxury things, but a lot of cars too. So that's kind of what I do.
And you were writing about watches a bit back then too,
cars,
right?
I mean, watches, motorcycles, jewelry, beauty items, travel, adventure. I mean, all of the things that you want to spend your money on are the things that I write about. And even it's funny because when I started, my title was lifestyle reporter.
Okay.
And that included everything. And that's kind of what I knew and loved. But over the years, it's gradually become more and more and more cars, which is really interesting. And it's not anything I planned, but it's just happened. And it's great. You know, I don't come from a car background at all, but at this point I've covered them so much that it's really fun. I love it. Second nature now.
And also a little known fact about Hannah Elliott is she was also the editor of a literature and book blog at Forbes. And she was gracious enough to let me write for
her. That's really kind. Okay. I honestly totally forgot about that, but it's really true.
That is true.
And I think one of the reasons why Ben and I get along so well is because, yes, we have like this thing that we're known for, which is, for Ben it's watches, for me it's cars. But actually, we're interested in a whole bunch of things, and Magnus too, and I'll let him talk about that later. But like, we have a specialty, but actually we're interested in a lot of things, and it all kind of goes together. I love seeing how culture and literature and everything else influences cars. I think the most boring person is someone who's only interested in one thing. Yeah. You know, so I love like being around people who are interested in a lot of things, and maybe that informs their one passion. But yeah, that's true. I forgot about that. Yeah, yeah, that was a long time ago.
Yeah. I remember actually the first time Hannah. I think it's the first time we met was early Hodinkee days. Ben and I were just like working away. He got a phone call and he goes, "All right, we gotta go. Come with me." And I was like, "Okay, what's going on?" And we walked outside and you pulled up in an R8.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That sounds about right.
The first R8. Yeah. The keys. Yeah. And we went cruising on the West Side Highway. And I was like, wait a minute, this is my job? Like, this is what I'm doing
for
a living?
That's really true. Yeah. And I mean, Ben and I have, I remember you telling me you were going to go look at a green Porsche.
Yeah.
Like a green old Porsche. And then it got to the point of where, like, we went to this garage on the West Side Highway and drove it. And it's a whole thing. And it's great because the cars are like entry points into memory that you have with people. Yeah. And in the end, it's not even about the car. It's about the memory. It's about the person, blah, blah, blah. But the car is the entry point into it, which I really love too.
Yeah.
But I totally forgot about that. Yeah.
Those are early days.
Early days.
Early days. Yeah.
Yeah. And then Hannah and I met when I was still writing about cars for AskMen.com, which was a thing.
AskMen.com.
Still is a thing, I guess.
I remember those days.
Exactly. I shouldn't say that, actually. for AskMen.com. They were like the number one like men's web. They had like 10 million uniques in a month, like way back. Like 10 years ago, you know?
Yeah.
And I was covering a Bentley, which is where we met.
Exactly.
The new Continental Super Sport,
something
like that.
Yes, and we kind of gravitated to each other because we were the only ones under like 45
correct.
Or so
yes.
on that.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
And I was definitely the only female, and it was just
no question.
Let's talk. Yeah.
Let's go be normal somewhere.
And I say that with love because I love the Bentley team. This was a long time. This was a long time ago. Yeah.
Rule Britannia.
Yeah. Rule Britannia. But yeah, great. You know, like minds find each other, I think. And that's also why I love New York City, because it's a big city, but it's really not. Like, if you're here for a while, you just kind of gravitate toward people with the same mentality. And now, I mean, just the fact that you worked at Bloomberg and now we have this partnership. And I mean, it's a very small world.
Yeah. Full disclosure, Hannah and I worked together for, I guess, what, like a year and a half
at
Bloomberg as part of the Pursuits team over there.
What was Stephen like as a coworker?
Great.
Be honest.
See?
He was terrific.
Yeah?
He was the exact thing that I want from a coworker, which is
good hair.
Super nice. Yeah. Super nice. Really fun. Like, good energy. Never mean or, like, bitter or anything. But also, like, not overly anything. Like,
that's what I'm talking about. Not overly anything. I love it.
That's your next review. Not overly anything.
I did not pay Hannah to say this, I swear.
I just want to, like, get in, do my work, like, be normal, and then leave. And, like, it was the perfect.
Yeah. That team was good at that.
Terrific.
Yeah.
And still is.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Chris says hi,
by the way. Thank you. Yeah. I saw him in Geneva recently.
Yeah.
We were talking about how few of that original team is still around.
I know.
But all doing good things.
All doing great things. Yeah. I mean, I think it's a good, I miss them, like Tejal, for instance, our food critic went to the New York Times. You can't argue with that. I think others have gone to the New Yorker. I mean, it's quite a distinguished group who have left. So that's a good sign too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Magnus,
everything.
You did not come to the car world as a journalist.
No, I'm just an enthusiast, man with a beard, had a dream as
we
a
like
kid.
We like those. You enthusiastic know. Guys with beards.
Yeah, you know. So whole group is what I call the BBMC, the Bearded Brother Man Club.
Yeah.
No, I'm just a dreamer that, you know, loved cars as a kid, had the poster on the wall, and still an enthusiast, you know, well over 40 years later. So that's sort of the short version of a long, winding story. But Porsche is my drug of choice, my religion. But I like to drive anything that's out there. To me, it represents freedom, and it's all about variety. And so that's the key to cars. You know, I think we all speak the language of the car. I often say we all speak Porsche. But I think what brings everyone together is the thrill of the chase of the car. Like Hannah said earlier on, the memorable moments that bring people together. Because without the people, the car is just what I call an appliance. It never moves. So. You know, people always like to tell me stories about their cars, and I'm generally interested in cars with high miles because they've got a lot of interesting stories. People that love to show me cars with 50 miles that have never been driven, that's not quite as interesting for me. But I've been able to travel all over the world and do some interesting drives in interesting places. Perhaps one of the most interesting ones was last year in Australia. Drove across the Simpson Desert, 3,500 kilometers, most of it off-road, across this thing called the Big Red, the Simpson Desert, Uluru. So that was kind of challenging. And
what did you drive?
It was a Porsche Cayenne, actually. Huh. I've done some pretty interesting drives in the Porsche Cayenne. That was one of them. Part of Porsche's World Expedition. So they were doing all seven continents, and that was the kickoff, essentially driving around the world. One of the more interesting runs was also in a Porsche Cayenne that was from down in Colombia, from Bogota to Medellin. That was a real memorable drive. That one was pretty exciting.
That one sounded hairy.
Yeah, that one was pretty hairy.
No pun intended.
Yeah. And perhaps one of the craziest ones was down in the Dominican Republic, because that's kind of like a free-for-all down there. You know, I describe my driving style as spirited, but down there it's kind of out of control, you know.
Got it.
It really is a free-for-all. There are no speed limits, it seems, and the road surfaces are not great, and you never know literally what is around the corner. Mm-hmm. Could be four people on the back of a moped or seven people getting out of a taxi with goats and sheep and all types of interesting things. So certainly spirited driving down there, and I just like fun drives, and enjoying the car world is essentially my story. Spending a lot of time here with Hannah in New York. I'm on a current crusade. We just got back from Miami, so I'm chasing a slant-nosed Porsche. Mm. I've looked at a lot of them. That was the first Porsche I ever bought when I was 25. So
no kidding.
I've owned a lot of 911s over the past, 27 years?
Uh-huh.
Bought the first one back in 1992 when I was 25. You know, I had a dream. I was 10-year-old. I had the poster on the wall. The story's pretty familiar, but for those that don't know, my dad took me to the London Earls Court Motor Show in 1977. I had the white Martini Turbo on the wall, and I actually wrote a letter to Porsche as a 10-year-old and said, hey, I'd love to design cars for you. And back then, you know, they wrote letters back to people and said, hey, essentially call us when you're older. And I never gave up on that dream. Eventually owned my first Porsche at the age of 25. And that represented sort of a dream come true, personal accomplishment, and ultimately a sense of freedom. And literally 41 years after I saw that car, I actually got to drive it. Hmm. Last October, I went back to England and did something I'd never done, which was drive a Porsche in my hometown of Sheffield, and got to make a video with the exact car that I fell in love with Porsche back in 1977 for Porsche's YouTube channel. So that was what I call a memorable moment. And I think that's what, you know, sort of brings people together, is the memorable moments and the stories that we share throughout the car. You know, the car is just the vehicle that takes you on the journey of life. So
did that car live up to the dream?
That's a good question.
It's a great question.
I love it when a journalist tells you asked a good question. That's when it feels good.
The honest answer is no. The car wasn't running.
That's
great.
An even better answer.
Yeah. I mean, the story behind it in the video, the car had a fuel pump issue, so it literally wouldn't really rev above probably 1500 RPM without cutting out and stalling. So it was tricky to drive the car because it literally would just stall, wouldn't really idle. So that really affected the video and the nature of the video. The video came out, I think, pretty great. It's pretty moody. It's really the story of never giving up on the dream. Mm-hmm. I think that's a relatable story that a lot of people have also shared with me. So to answer the question, no. But I find a lot of cars are sometimes like that.
Never meet your heroes.
Yeah, it's a little bit like meeting your rock star heroes. You know, I was just down in Miami on this slant nose quest and drove a few cars down there, which in theory looked awesome, but in practicality didn't quite drive that way. So sometimes less is more, but I'm still searching. So the quest never ends. The journey continues.
So how have you found that each other's approaches have kind of impacted how you each do your job? Because I would imagine that, you know, it's in some ways you want to kind of like focus on your perspective and what you're doing, but you have this very other perspective there. How does that work for you guys?
Well, to clarify, I actually don't have an automotive job. That's Hannah's beat. You know, for me, this thing's a hobby. It's an out of control hobby. But for clarification, I'm a collector and I'm an enthusiast. I don't build cars for other people. I build cars for myself. I seldom sell cars. So for me, I just tag along with Hannah with her plus one, getting to drive all these super exciting cars.
That is not a bad way to live life.
Yeah, for sure. You know, I carry the bags and joining on the journey. So for me, it's been great spending a lot of time with Hannah over the past 18 months, getting to see parts of the world I've never seen before. And I have the freedom to travel. So I travel with Hannah quite a bit, and sometimes I'm able to get her to join me on some of my drives around the world. We were just down in Mexico City, and we've been a few other places. But for me, it's a little bit different because, like I say, I don't actually write about cars.
Well, I'll ask you, maybe you've seen the inside of other automakers that you wouldn't normally have seen.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it's all about variety. I've driven a lot of supercars, you know, stuff that I'm not really interested in owning, but I've driven them. You know, someone says, do you want to drive a Pagani Huayra? Sure, I'll go drive that car. I think one of my most memorable, let's call it non-Porsche drive moments, was in Miami about 18 months ago in a Ferrari F40, which is, you know, top five, I think, dream car for anybody, you know. Doesn't matter what you're into. I think the F40 is at least top 10 for a lot of people. So for me, that was a real memorable, spirited drive. I happened to get pulled over by the Miami Police Department. it was like one too many runs over Key Biscayne Boulevard, the bridge there down into Key Biscayne in Miami. And another fun story, it was a friend of a friend acquaintance, what I call OPC, other people's cars. And this happened to be on dealer plates.
Got it.
No paperwork. I couldn't find any insurance. I was on a California driver's license. It was looking a little bit sticky for a few minutes, but in the end, we got away with...
Oh, you're very charming.
We got away with no ticket and just a slowdown warning.
To answer your question from my side, I think the great thing about being around Magnus for my job is that I see what a real enthusiast is versus people who are in the industry. Yeah. I'm used to talking to people who are in the industry who are, you know, executives, PR people, designers, all of that. With Magnus, you see how an enthusiast consumes cars. It's quite different than people who are paid to be around cars. So that's been really informative and good. And it's forced me to slow down and to see things kind of on the edges. Because as a journalist, I'm pretty like just going in. I've got my thing. I talk to my people. I do da-da-da-da-da. Very single-minded. With Magnus being around a true enthusiast, you kind of start to see peripheral things that I would have definitely missed as a journalist, just being very goal-oriented. Yeah.
Are we allowed to talk about cars? Can we go deep on cars?
Yeah, we can go deep on cars.
So the F40, because that's like a dream car for me.
F40.
Somebody told me this past weekend that the F40 feels like the fastest car you'll ever drive. Because it's like right before things got kind of digital and
it's an intoxicating drive. Don't tell nobody, but at one time I owned a 308 GTB Ferrari.
Oh, wow.
79. You know, I jokingly call it the poor man's Ferrari when it was a 20 grand car.
Sure.
And the F40, in a strange way, was like a 308 GTB on steroids, meaning that when you get in it, it wasn't really that much different. It was raw. Obviously, it was a lot faster, but it wasn't really difficult to drive, let's say, like a Porsche Carrera GT, where you're constantly a little bit edgy. So for me, the Ferrari F40 was familiar, and it just had a real big wallop, but it wasn't by today's standards, you know, what's it got, 450 horsepower, something like that. I mean, today you can go buy a Mopar off the showroom floor with 800 horsepower, a Hellcat. So, you know, the Ferrari's 30 years old. I wouldn't say it's the fastest car I've ever driven. I would say it's one of the most intoxicating cars I've ever driven, where you just didn't want to get out of it.
Right.
The Carrera GT's the same way. For me, the Pagani Huayra wasn't like that. You know, I drove a Lamborghini Countach. That wasn't like that. Mm-hmm. You know, I think any kid growing up anywhere in the world in the late 70s, early 80s, chances are you had three posters on your wall. Pretty common story. Porsche Turbo, Ferrari F40, or Berlinetta Boxer, or possibly Lamborghini Countach. Mm-hmm. So someone said to me, you know, you want to drive in the Lamborghini Countach? Sure, no problem. But everything about it was awkward. You know, it wasn't fast. It felt heavy. Yeah. Visibility wasn't great. Pedal position wasn't great. You couldn't heel and toe. The steering was off. And then you go get in a 911 of the same era, and everything's organically, ergonomically where it needs to be. Mm-hmm. Visibility's great. The pedal setup's great. So to answer your question on the F40, if you ever get a chance, drive it, because it is a super intoxicating car. I actually really want to drive the 288 GTO. Mm-hmm. You know, I sort of want to drive that evolution of them. So I've driven quite a lot of exotic cars, and that's definitely one of the top five memorable moments for sure in a car.
So you've never driven this car, Ben?
No, never.
All right. So if you're listening to this and you have one or have access to one, hit us up.
Yes.
Hit us up. We're going to get Ben in this car.
Bring it on by.
Very good.
I'm kind of thinking this may actually result in
100%. So our audience for sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
So yeah, we got to get you in this car.
Okay.
We should definitely go deeper on cars. But before we get too far away from it, I just wanted to talk about watches for a little bit, just because we probably should, right? It's probably not a bad idea. So yeah, Hannah, you already mentioned that you covered watches for a little while.
Mm-hmm.
What was it like now, kind of looking back as somebody who's primarily covering another industry? Mm-hmm. What kind of perspective can you give us over on your time covering watches? Like, what was that experience like? How is it different from what you're doing now? Are watches still something you're interested in? Kind of if you can share a little of that.
Yeah, that's another great question.
This is why we have you on.
Yeah. You know, the thing is, I would say watch buyers and readers and aficionados are like the same people with cars, but even more intense.
Yes.
I would say it's like if you're looking at a pyramid and watches are at the top of the tiny, tiny, super intense level and the car people are kind of down. It's the same type of mentality. It's the same type of collector. But with watches, it's just so narrow and tiny and minute. And it's just a turn of the knob to the right and maybe Vin,
sounds
you see,
like a boost control.
Yeah, yeah. I find them fascinating. Like Jane Goodall studying the apes, I would say. I find them fascinating and endearing. And it's really interesting. I think a watch means something very important to especially a man who would wear a watch. I mean, I always talked about how men don't really have that many opportunities for individuality, really, especially with jewelry and accessories. Maybe they wear a wedding ring. Maybe they wear cufflinks. Maybe they wear reading glasses.
Monogram shirts.
Yeah, maybe. But then you're even getting
those,
a little,
right?
little more flashy.
I got a lot of those.
Yeah.
So the watch really means something, and it's quite a bit like a secret club or handshake.
Secret society.
You know that if you see someone who, if you know what you're looking at, you're in the club, and that means a lot. And it's. It's like cars. Cars are more obvious. The watch is even more subtle. It's more intense. It's more concentrated. So I am definitely still interested in watches. I mean, I like vintage things in general. So I'm not up on, you know, I don't go to SIHH anymore. I don't go to Basel anymore, although I did and loved it. And I do miss it from time to time just because it's so fascinating. I think it's an important part of culture, and so I don't know, it's great to see car buyers are less intense than watch guys, but it's the same type of guy, if that makes sense.
Yeah
I think humans like to collect. You know what I've noticed is guitars, cars, watches, these things, you know, obtainable.
Yep.
I think they define, you know, it's like I think they define a certain individual's taste.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're a Porsche guy, you're a Ferrari guy. You're a Gibson guy, you're a Fender guy. You're an Omega guy, or you're a Rolex guy, right? You know, there's certain categories that things fall into, and then you just break it on down. I think the thing with watches is, you know, it sort of does sort of define who you are a little bit, or your taste level, who you are. And whether it's a vintage one or a new one, you know, personally, I like to collect vintage watches. We're always looking at watches. And I think, you know, like I say, people just like to collect, you know, different tastes, different watches for all occasions. For me, it's always Porsche time, so I'm a PD guy. Ironically, my father, though, as a kid growing up, he actually played around with clocks and watches. He had a little business where he repaired clocks and watches. So we never had anything fancy, but we had a bunch of broken sort of grandfather clocks, grandmother clocks, pocket watches. You know, my mom, I remember, had a Cartier, what is it, that Reverso tank watch?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
She had one of those, and my dad had some Tudors. Never anything sort of super fancy like Rolexes. You know, that was never his thing, never really my thing. But, you know, my cousin lives in Switzerland near the Valle du Jura, so I visited that area. So, you know, it's kind of a little bit in the blood, you know. Mm-hmm. I always try to be on time, if not early. So.
You love that?
Yeah.
And you're doing a project in the watch world coming up, aren't you?
Yeah, I actually am. You know, it's funny. I get approached by, I've probably been approached by half a dozen watch manufacturers at various price points to do various things. And I'm pretty excited. I'm finally, after this thing's been going for almost 3 years.
I believe it.
To do a watch with Porsche design. You know, it's interesting. The first sort of watch I bought myself was an Omega Speedmaster. And that
it's
little,
a good choice.
Yeah, mm-hmm. You know, for me, I was never really a Rolex guy. I'm a Gibson guy when it comes to guitars, and not that the two go together, but for me, they always did. It's like my uncle had a Rolex GMT, and I was never really a Rolex guy. I was always more of an Omega guy. Mm-hmm. So probably 10, 15 years ago, I bought myself an Omega Speedmaster. And I was always trying to get a pre-Man on the Moon one, the one I got. I actually bought that watch store on Melrose, want to buy a watch.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I bought it from those guys when Omega Speedmasters, I guess, were affordable.
Sure.
They seem to have gone up 10 times what I paid for mine. But anyway, here's a point to the Omega Speedmaster story. So in 2012, Tamir Moscovici, this Canadian film director, made a little short documentary film, which I always have to throw props to him. And the film was called Urban Outlaw. And in that film, I'm wearing the Omega Speedmaster, and I'd been sent this little blog of, there was a thread going on about what watch I was wearing in the film. I'm like, how do you even see the watch in the film? So there's like one little scene where I'm driving my 66 911. You see my hand on the wheel, and you see the watch in the shot, and everyone, all of a sudden, there's a pretty big thread on what was the watch I was wearing and what year was it. And I wasn't really aware of just how intense this watch world was.
Concentrated.
I wasn't like really in it, but there was a whole thread going on about, is that an Omega Speedmaster? What year is it? Blah, blah, blah. So I was always an Omega guy, but being a Porsche guy, you know, one of my prized possessions is this first year 1972 Porsche design watch.
It's a super cool watch.
Yeah, you know, it's beat up. It's got character. You know, I like things that are old and beat up and have got patina. So 3 years in the making. You guys want a little sneak peek of this thing?
Yeah, I'd love to.
Of course, I've got it on my phone. Of course, this is all off the record, unofficial, blah, blah, blah. But you guys can get a sneak peek of it. So this is what it's like. You know, it's a new flyback movement, signature series.
Oh, wow.
So it's actually an honor to have that.
That's awesome.
You know, of course, working with Porsche for me is an honor. Of course, it's been an ongoing process where I was trying to get them to sort of tumble the case and make it a little beat up. And of course, that's not so much the Porsche aesthetic.
And that's ceramic or what is that? Or PVD?
Yeah, it's PVD.
Yeah.
So this is, you know, now they're making their own case, making their own movement. Mm-hmm. So I'm pretty excited about it. Now we're just at the final stages trying to figure out how many we're making. Is it numbered? Is it limited? What's the story behind it? Mm-hmm. Apparently, I'm going to go visit the factory and sort of be there when the watch is going together. So for me, it's quite an honor to sort of be doing that with Porsche. It's kind of exciting, and we'll see where that takes us.
Yeah, that's a cool thing.
That's
yeah.
super cool.
Yeah,
what
I'm
do you think,
excited.
In your guys' opinion, what's better, limited or, what'd you say, numbered or limited?
You know, there seems to be a few ways. You know, they're either making 50 or 277 or 911 or they're just numbered, i.e., you know, your lucky number is 666. You want 666 on the watch. You can have that number. I think the thing with numbered is, you know, there is no actual quantity determined.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's just numbered. So
what's your take on that?
What's your take on that?
I was literally in a meeting about 2 hours ago talking about this for projects that we're doing. Like literally.
Yeah.
I mean, it all depends on what the goal is. Like, you know, for a lot of the brands that we work with, they want the story of selling out quickly.
Mm, right.
Of
and
course.
If you want to do that, you do limited. X out of
limited.
You know, X plus.
Right.
So then people know, like, there's a finite number and that's it. If you do number, people get excited about it, but they don't feel that, like, overwhelming
urgency to go
exactly.
get it.
So if you wanted to go quickly, I would say, you know, definitely number them and do a limited series. But if you want something that's just kind of like a part of you and could be a part of you for a long time, then maybe just number them, not out of a series,
right.
but just number them, you know? And, you know, we've done both. Like with our Octavia, we did just a numbered series.
Yep.
And then the rest of them have been limited editions. So limited editions, like, they go. Like they go like within an hour, you know, sometimes a little bit more.
Wow.
Less. But it all depends on what the goal is. And, you know, the things, when stuff goes so quickly, it kind of limits you and it limits the upside, obviously.
Right.
Like once it's done, you know?
Right. A few years ago, I did this limited steering wheel with Momo. Mm-hmm. Momo celebrated, and for those that don't know, Momo makes steering wheels and seats, but they're pretty famous for making steering wheels. And if you're a Porsche guy, chances are you probably got a Momo Prototipo in your car. And for the 50th anniversary in 2015, I did a signature steering wheel with Momo. And they'd never done a signature steering wheel with a non-professional race car driver. So it was my heroes, Jackie Stewart, Jackie Ickx, Mario Andretti, Clay Regazzoni. And I had my own signature steering wheel. It was a combination of the Jackie Stewart thick grip with the Momo Prototipo combined. And then I got them to distress the leather. So it sort of looked beat up like an old patinaed watch or, you know, leather shoes or whatever. And they did a limited run of them. Mm-hmm. They only did 400. And the exact thing happened. They sold out really quick.
Yep.
And of course, now people want them, but it's never coming back.
Yeah.
So it's like those that got them literally within the first 2 weeks of them selling out, great. But still to this day, people are, you ever going to do that Momo steering wheel again?
It seems a shame not to.
So I think that's where the numbered thing comes in. Yeah. You know, there is no limit. I've done a lot of stuff with Hot Wheels, for example.
Mm-hmm.
I did a collaboration that started with one car 3 years ago. And now I'm up to like 20 of them. So Hot Wheels, literally, Hot Wheels has done this current thing, which I was going to bring one and of course forgot it. The little 964 one, which I was going to bring for you guys. But they actually did a...
That's sweet.
Yeah, they did a 277 version of my car. Now those, they made 500,000 of them.
The actual car.
That one's gone around the world with me. So I was talking about all these memorable drives across Australia and down in Colombia. That's my, like my lucky charm. That thing goes in my pocket and travels with me all around the world.
That is so cool.
So those are examples of, you know, something that's done in big volume. That's a 99-cent car. But the greatest thing about that is the great giveaways for everyone.
It's amazing. That's the dream, really, to have your car made.
So cool.
And everyone kind of has a Hot Wheels story back to growing up as a kid. You know, it's like whether you're 5 or whether you're 100, people can relate to having a model car, whatever it is.
No question.
Yeah. You know, it's back to that little kid that had the poster, the dream, whatever it was you wanted to be, race car driver or car designer. You know, that's kind of a cool thing, and I carry that around with me all over the world.
Also, the impulse to collect.
Yeah, well, I keep going back to collecting, right? Whether you collect stamps, flies when you go fishing, fishing rods, rocks, hats, jewelry, whatever. So.
And now a look at this week's sponsor. The Clifton Bowmatic is a collection of watches from Baume & Mercier that combines classic looks with modern movement technology. Best exemplifying this approach is the Clifton Bowmatic Cosque. Starting with a stainless steel case, a clean white dial, and razor-sharp hands and hour markers, the Bowmatic Cosque is a great everyday timekeeper. As you look closer, you'll find more details, though, like the crosshair dial and the subtle date to hold your interest. Inside is a brand new in-house movement with a 5-day power reserve and a silicone escapement to round things out. Baume & Mercier is also offering all of this for a very competitive price, making cool modern watchmaking a little more attainable. You can learn more about this watch and the entire Bowmatic collection by visiting BowmanMercier.com. All right, let's get back to the show.
I've heard you say that your goal is to collect an example of every sports car that Porsche's ever made. Is that still your goal?
Yeah, I'm a goal-oriented collector. So it started out with a specific 64 through 73. That was the early years, and it was a first-generation 3-liter turbos. So I achieved those goals. The new goal is one of everything Porsche's ever made in a sports car. So that's front engine, mid-engine, rear engine, both air and water-cooled. So everything from the 356 all the way up to the current car. You know, for me, I'm not such a purist that it has to be air-cooled, even though I've owned a lot of air-cooled cars. You know, for me, if there's a Porsche badge on it, it's a unique experience that I need to sort of participate in. Some of my favorite cars are, you know, I have a few 924s that are pretty awesome, a couple of 928s. Just bought a 968 that we're trying to figure out how to drive it back from Florida. We just don't seem to have time. The car's down
These
in Daytona.
First world problems.
Yeah, first world problems to have. But yeah, when it comes to Porsche, it's one of everything. You know, it's for me, I've always sort of collected what I personally liked, which later on became, let's call it trendy. But for me, I was getting these things when they were affordable.
Right.
And I did always say, sort of changed a little bit now, but I bought my first one over 25 years ago. And Porsches were affordable back then. You know, I always say what separated Porsche from all the other sports cars were they were obtainable. You'd see a lot of high-mileage 911s because people drove them, unlike other marques where people didn't drive them quite as much because they weren't quite as reliable, let's say. So that, to me, is always the greatest thing about the Porsche is the reliability and the driving experience. But long answer to your question, yeah, that's true. Now it's one of everything. And then I've been fortunate enough to drive what I call OPP, other people's Porsches. These are the cars that I can't afford, the, you know, the supercars, the 959s, Carrera GTs, 918s. But that's the great thing about the Porsche community is, you know, it's sort of the car brings everyone together from whatever background you're from. You know, I've been invited to a lot of places that I never thought I'd go to and driven cars I never thought I'd have accessibility to, just because I think the community is really pretty open.
Yeah, you said you're not a purist, and I think that's another interesting thing to touch on. Is, you know, a lot of people, you know, everything has to be air cooled, it has to be unrestored, it has to be, you know, perfectly pristine as it left the factory. Right. You're not that way.
No, I'm not that way. I mean, I have a 64 911. You know, that's a pretty holy grail car. Porsche only made 232 of those. There's like 70 documented surviving. People always ask me, what determines, you know, whether the car gets modified or not? And to me, it's always the car that determines whether it gets modified or not. And what I mean by that is, at one time I had 567Ss, which is sort of a holy grail car. But when I was collecting them, nobody really cared about them. And of those five, only two had original motors. So it was a classic case of, here's a 67S with a 2.2 liter T motor in it. You know, the guy probably blew up the 67S motor, who knows, 10, 20 years ago, went to his regular mechanic who said, hey, it's going to cost X amount of dollars and 6 months to rebuild this S motor, or I can put that 2.2 T motor in the corner there and I'll have it to you next week for $1,500. That was kind of a common story with these early short wheelbase cars. So I've modified quite a few 67Ss. One of them's perhaps the most performance-orientated car I've built to date. It's a 67S that my buddy Matthias in Hoeng Motorsports in Hamburg took a non-matching numbers 67S case and built it out to a twin-plug 2.5 motor that dynoed at 271 horsepower. Wow. And then I built my sort of sport-purpose 3RR-inspired car around that shell. And so there's a perfect example of, to some people, what would be a holy grail car that's been modified. So to me, the car always determines, like the 64 911, that doesn't get hot rodded. I have a couple of 75 turbos. That's the first year of the Porsche turbo. When I think of Porsche, I think of that turbo. So that's not a car that I'm going to modify because they only made like 282 of them. So that's a pretty rare car. But, you know, Porsche's made well over a million 911s. So there's a lot out there running around that, you know, have been modified over the years. No two ever drive the same. So to me, it always comes back to variety. And I think one of the greatest things about early 911s, the first 30 years, everything's sort of interchangeable. You know, you can put a 3.6 motor in a short wheelbase car if you want, and then you go down the slippery slope of, you know, trying to determine when you stop the modification. Because, you know, you go bigger, you got to upgrade suspension and brakes and the rest of it. But half the cars I own are sort of unrestored, numbers matching cars, and people just tend to focus more on the modified stuff because possibly it's a little bit more unique or a little bit more exciting to talk about. To me, it always boils back to variety. And to me, it's all about the journey and where you want to go. If I want to step back in time, let's say over 50 years, one of my favorite cars, my Irish Green 66 911, that to me is the closest thing I can do to stepping back in time and going on that journey. You know, and I talk about it quite a bit. 100 miles an hour on a short wheelbase stock car on narrow tires feels really, really fast.
Yes.
150 miles an hour in a new 991 doesn't feel nearly as fast as doing 100 in that short wheelbase car on 165 profile and 4.5-inch wheels, you know, and tires. So it's a matter of how you want to go, how you want to experience the journey for me is to determine what car I drive and what gets modified.
So tell me about the 64.
Well, it's a long story. You know, every car has a story. You know, it's the birth of the 911. And, you know, Porsche, as we know, just celebrated its 70th anniversary last year, June 8th. They made the Gamon Coupe. And then what people forget, because now we're at this pinnacle of Porsche's sort of moving away or moving into a new era. The whole world all of a sudden has accelerated 125 years and compressed it down into the next 5 years, if everything's going to go hybrid electric, internal combustion motor is going to stop. But the answer to the 64 911, when that car came out, the 356 guys, the purists, they didn't like the 911. Just like, you know, now the 992 is getting a lot of love-hate, whether you like it or not. So the 64 to me is the real birth of the 911. Without that car, there would be no eighth generation 992. So that's the simplest, purest shape. You know, my car I found, not accidentally, this was probably 10 years ago, I was on a crusade, ads everywhere. And here's a great story about the Porsche world. I got an email from a guy, Joost Hermes, in the Netherlands, who'd found this car, and it was on a non-Porsche car blog. And the guy was just asking about a little bit of information on his 64 911. Wasn't actually for sale. And the good news was, none of the Porsche guys out there knew about it. And it was a familiar story. It was car number 174. It had been U.S. serviceman stationed in Europe somewhere in the late 60s imported the car into the country. I bought it from the third owner who acquired the car, early 70s. And I always talk about these cars, you know, probably 90% of the cars I own have never been for sale. So it's word of mouth. Like, I just got offered a car today, funnily enough, car number 147. And I just have to listen to the people share their story, you know, because it's sort of like going out on a first date. I always say you never want to push your luck and, you know, get your hand slapped by going too far. So you sort of got to listen to the guy tell the whole story. And the story of my 64 was great. The guy brought it over to the States. Told me how he was living in Connecticut and drove down to Florida and got pulled over by a state trooper. He had a joint in the car. He had to pay him $100 not to get the car impounded. And he drove the car for a few years and then parked it in the mid-70s. Started a business, had a family, had a couple of kids. And he was also a Harley-Davidson Corvette guy. So the 911 just sort of got backburnered, got put up on jack stands in the garage. Hadn't been on the road since 1979. So the car was originally slate gray with a red interior, and believe it or not, the guy I bought it from painted it white because he didn't like slate gray.
Wow.
And this was in the early 70s. So the car had been off the road since 79, so most of its life it had been off the road, and that kind of survived it from getting sort of what I call the Miami Vice slant-nose turbo wide-body conversion because, you know, all these short-wheel-based cars a few years, well, 10, 15, 20 years ago, a lot of people didn't really care about them.
Right.
There were super cheap, and a lot of them got cut up into 80s looking wide bodied turbos. So my car escaped that whole thing. And of the 232 that are made, if you want to crunch numbers, I think there's 70 documented on the registry that exist in the world. Of those 70, I think there's probably a little over three dozen that have an original motor. Mine has an original motor, slate gray red interior. But if you look at it in the garage, it just looks like all the other old 911s. But the car's complete, it's all there. But I started acquiring these things when, like I say, I had five of the first 1,000 911s. I had car number 310, a real early 65 911. That's still in my garage. That was imported by a Brumos Porsche. I had car number 540, 836, and I think 1032. So every car has a story, you know, and I just remember these stories because I'm connected to them because they're interesting to me. So that's just sort of the story on the 64 911.
Yeah, you know. I think after the pod is over, I'll talk to you about the car at RM Sotheby's coming up because there's a 64 coming up in Paris next week. Have you seen that car?
That's where we're going tomorrow.
Yeah.
We're on it. We were in Miami yesterday and we're off to Paris tomorrow. So.
Gotcha. Yeah.
You know, it's a small world. The car world's a small world, like the watch world's a small world. You know, we've traveled all over the place and everyone sort of has a story like that. And that's what's great. I think that's what brings everyone together. And it's like I was saying earlier on, I'm not really interested in a car with 50 miles on it, but right. A car that's got all these great stories, it's what I call memorable moments. That's what's great about the car world. It doesn't have to be Porsche. That, as I say, just happens to be my drug of choice.
So if you need us to look at a car for you
noted.
In Paris
noted.
Tomorrow, we're very happy to.
We can discuss that later.
Yes.
So I actually wanted to talk about this whole part of the car world, right, is not what you do on a daily basis, mm-hmm. right? Like, you're really focused on new cars mm-hmm. for the most part, and a lot of what you're doing is acting as a critic, which mm-hmm. is a very different way to approach this than as an enthusiast, right?
Yes. Yeah. I people ask me all the time, what is your favorite car? And I have no answer for that because the best car...
I'm sure you love getting asked that question constantly.
Yeah, it's okay. I mean, it's a fair question and it's a question that makes sense. But really, the best car is the best one for the job in a given situation. And you know, I'm a big believer in the fact that it really has nothing to do with price point or brand. If a car gets a job done and if it fulfills what it says it's going to do, it's a good car. That could be a Miata. That could be
which is
Tesla.
A great car, by the way.
Sure. There you go. I mean, a big question is a Miata a luxury car or not?
No. Hard no.
Hard no?
Hard.
But it's not an essential car. People have that as a toy.
It's a sports car, yeah. It's uh-huh. totally superfluous. You definitely don't need it.
But you don't consider...
You said a luxury car?
Yeah.
No. I don't think so.
I've heard people make the argument that it is because it's not essential. It's a toy. It's a add-on.
I could see that.
Yeah.
I don't agree with it, but I could see it.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. But anyway, so the point is, you know, I don't have a favorite car. I think the best car is the one for the job. And there are many, many good cars in the market today, especially with modern cars. It really comes down to, a lot of the time it comes down to taste. What brand do you like better? You know, what story do you like better that the brand is telling you? And that's great. I mean, 50 years ago, you had to worry about like maybe actually getting hurt in a car. And now cars are so safe compared to what we used to have and are so much more comfortable and easy to use and all of that. So all of that's great. It's now largely a question of taste and branding and all that.
So yeah. As a critic, if your job isn't, I mean, like you said, like 50 years ago, mm-hmm. part of a car critic's job was to be like, are you going to die in this
car? Maybe. Right?
Like,
yeah.
Is this car going to send your kid through the windshield when you stop at a light? Right?
Uh-huh.
Like, that's not a problem anymore. Uh-huh. And a lot of it comes down to these matters of taste. So when, you know, you get a call from brand X and they say, hey, we have the new model year. We're going to swing it by the office. You can have it for a couple of days for a review. When you first, you know, go downstairs and go to get that car, like what are the first things you're kind of looking for? How do you approach kind of coming up with something to say about a new car you've never seen before?
The first thing is the looks. I mean, I say all the time, I like beautiful things. And that could be a car, it could be a watch, it could be a Magnus, it could be anything. You know, so well, I like beautiful things. I do think there is a absolute beauty in the world. I do think you can say unequivocally something looks beautiful or not. Now, obviously, that's 2 degrees, but I think the number one thing is, do the proportions work for whatever model it is? Do the proportions work? Does it go along with the rest? Does it fit in with the rest of the brand? And then you go into, you know, does the car deliver on the price point? Especially, you know, is it worth whatever they're asking for? And then you can go down a whole list of questions with that too. But you know, where does it fall in the segment compared to other cars that you might buy or consider versus that car? I mean, Audi, Mercedes, BMW, if you're looking at their sedans, are they interchangeable? Depends on who you ask, maybe.
Are they?
For sure.
That's a hard yes.
Yeah. Between those three, no. Between the SUVs, maybe.
Yeah.
Between the sedans, no, I don't think so. Between the SUVs, maybe. And SUVs are the biggest market today in cars.
And, I mean, so this brings up a question that we get asked all the time. It's like, you work for a major publication. If you destroy the new BMW, we'll say. I mean, BMW will contact you. And
of
they will contact your editors and your the powers that be.
Of course.
Your publisher.
Yeah. Will they contact Mayor Mike?
No. I don't think so. Hopefully, you know, he may be running for president. He's going to be busy.
Yeah. He's a little above that.
You know, circumstances matter in cases like that. For instance, if I was drunk and crashed the car, that would be a big problem.
Correct.
I would not have a job at the end of the day. If someone hit me and told the car, it might be a different thing.
Right.
Obviously, I've been doing this for 15 years now. Knock on wood. There's a reason that I've stuck around. I am respectful and careful. But also, you can't be too precious with these things. I mean, they're cars. They're meant to be driven. Things happen. I'm a big believer in that.
So what happens, though, when you drive something and you don't like it and you don't think it delivers on its promise? And
oh, Hannah's real honest about this.
Yes.
And I've seen, I mean, obviously, I read your work.
Yes.
I've been in edit meetings where we've talked about your work. Like, what do you do when that happens and it's a brand like BMW or Mercedes or something from Ford, you know, something from a huge company, and like all of a sudden you have to come out and just be like, this isn't good. Like, this is just not a good thing.
I can give you a very real and recent example.
I included
a car from Lexus in the worst cars of the year that I drove last year. I did a roundup and I said, these were the worst cars I drove for all these reasons. And I included a Lexus on that list. And then in the next few weeks requested a different Lexus to drive, and they said no. And the reason for that was they felt that they didn't like what I wrote. For me, as long as the piece is accurate and fair, I'm comfortable with that. To answer your question, what happens sometimes is automakers say, we don't want you to drive our cars anymore. But that's actually only happened once, and that was with Lexis. And I don't have a problem saying that. And I stand by my review and the piece. I pretty much just say, and I say if I don't like it, and I say why. My big things are, it has to be accurate, number one, and it has to be fair. I am very happy to have conversations with people who think I'm unfair, because that furthers the relationship. And that's great. That's a healthy thing. And I'm always happy to listen. Yeah. I don't know if that answers your question.
No, but totally does.
And the editorial team at Bloomberg has always backed me up 100%. And if I say something is not good, for instance, when Fisker was making Karmas, they've since changed, but when they were making Fisker Karmas, I think that our headline was, "This is a very bad car, don't buy it," or something like that. I mean, just
that's a
really,
great
just
honest
comment.
I'm now running through my head. I'm trying to guess which editor wrote that headline.
Yeah, you know, you probably know. And that's like one of my all time most commented on stories. And I had the full backing of the editors to do
just
that
the
because
facts, H, just
Bloomberg
the facts.
Is independent. I mean, this is this
not
is what
a paid
happens.
Endorsement.
Yeah,
right. You see a lot of car magazines out there that sort of, you know, some car of the year. You go, how is that car of the year? And then maybe it's a paid endorsement to be car of the year.
Yeah. I don't like saying negative things, but also my responsibility is to readers, and I want readers to be able to trust me, and I want them to take seriously when I say this is good or this is not good. And the way that you earn and maintain that trust is telling them the truth. I don't report to automakers. I report to my editor and to readers.
Just the facts, H. Yeah. Just the facts.
Well, we're starting to get low on time. But before we go to the Hodinkee questionnaire, there's one other thing I wanted to touch on, which is enthusiast communities. So we've talked about it a bunch, but I wonder, how do you think enthusiast communities are changing and evolving, whether it's cars or watches or guitars? You know, we have so many inputs, and there's, you know, there's people publishing at, you know, kind of big major publications like what you're doing, Hannah. There's, you know, enthusiast driven publications like what we're doing. There's so much going on social media and on forums. Like there are so many inputs and so much information out there and so many visuals out there. I wonder how that's changing the way new enthusiasts get developed, how they're conditioned, and eventually, like, what that does to these communities.
Great question there, Rich.
Yeah. I mean, my initial reaction to that, just real quick, is that everything has been exponentially sped up because of social media. The number one thing that social media has done for enthusiast communities is just speed up everything. Speed up discovery, speed up acquisition, speed up everything.
Information.
I mean, it used to be that you might not see these rare cars or rare watches, you know, maybe once or twice a year, and then it was just like, oh my gosh. But now you see them all the time because we have social media. So it just speeds everything up, and I think it means that trends will move quicker. People's attention span is shorter, even when it comes to collecting. That's my quick response.
Good point right there.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a small world, like you say. I think accessibility is vast. I think when it comes to cars, you know, enthusiasts sort of fall into a few categories. I always say there's people that like to collect. They generally like to either hoard cars and never show them, or they love to roll them out on golf courses and have people with, you know, Q-tips and white gloves critique the cars, which is fine. You know, I say the automotive world's like a big piece of the pie and there's plenty of slices. You know, I still think that the driving community is really, really strong globally. People love to drive. I think that's the ultimate freedom that the car brings. When it comes to things that I'm interested in, guitars and watches, it's, you know, they're just all over the place. I mean, some of my favorite things are just looking at old guitar stores and old watch stores and antique stores. Hannah and I were at the Rose Bowl recently, which is sort of the greatest flea market, I think, for all things collectible, whether it's, you know, old Nike sneakers or old Levi's or old watches. So I think that enthusiast community is really strong. Hannah's actually wearing a watch that we bought there that doesn't work, but it's like a jewelry piece.
It. Well, it did work, you know, when we bought it.
Yeah, it's cool.
That's fine, yeah.
So
it's a roamer.
I think enthusiasts are stronger than ever. I think collecting is stronger than ever, whatever it is you're collecting, whether it's fossils, watches, guitars, or cars. I mean, I think the accessibility is the reach
discovery
is bigger than ever.
Bigger than ever.
And it's almost instantaneous. You know, you want something, right? You get out your phone, go online, I'm searching for whatever it may be, 64911, right? Or, you know, Rolex Daytona or slant nose Porsche or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. You know, there's plenty of availability and opportunity to access things and obtain things quicker than ever. So I think in reality, that's a good thing.
Great. Cool. Well, to wrap things up, we'll do our Hodinkee questionnaire. So these are a couple of quick fire questions. You can keep your answers nice and short and to the point. So the first one is, what's a watch that caught your eye recently?
For me, honestly, today I was literally looking through the Jaeger webpage and I just was admiring the ultra thin, just the whole line of their ultra thin. I mean, the Half Moon, it's timeless, it's classic. That's just top of mind. I literally saw those this afternoon.
Cool. Yep.
For me, vintage Swatch or probably one of those Casio little pocket calculator watches from the 80s.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, those are
one of those guys, I think. So that's my answer to that one.
For number two, what's the best place you've traveled in the last year?
Mexico City, for sure. Hmm. That's
Mexico City.
Yeah, that's the best new place. It's the colors, the flavors, the taste, the feel. It's so beautiful, the architecture, the food. I really loved it. And it's cheap. It's fun. I miss it.
Mexico City, I'm right there. Miami, real colorful. I really like that. And Colombia for me, probably Bogota and Medellin. You know, it's just something kind of exotic, exciting, big element of danger, bit of a rush there. Great driving in the sense of it's pretty hairball. It's adventurous. It's thrilling. Mexico City, for sure. I mean, we've gone there 3 times in the past year. So that is awesome. And the great thing about Mexico City, just to say, is the car culture down there is amazing.
It's cool.
Some of the cars we've
seen,
you'd never expect that are hidden away. Because a lot of those guys are not on social media flaunting the cars they've got for whatever reason.
Yeah.
But what they have there is pretty incredible.
It's awesome. Yeah.
Those are my three places. Mexico City, Miami, Colombia.
Perfect. Well, what's the best piece of advice you've ever received and who gave it to you?
The first thing that comes to my mind, whether I like it or not, is my dad saying, it's never too late to do the right thing.
Do the right thing.
I mean, it's been pounded into my head, I guess. It's just, it's never too late to do the right thing.
Perfect.
There you go.
Mine's pretty simple. Never give up.
There we go. And then we have, what is your guilty pleasure?
Fish and chips.
Good answer.
I would take some of that right now.
And let me tell you,
that sounds great.
It is hard to get a good fish and chips. I mean, I could ramble on about fish and chips, but we don't have time. But fish and chips.
We'll have you come back. We'll do the fish and chips cast.
Taste test on fish and chips.
I would say mine is Page Six.
Oh.
It's gossip news. I read it every day. And
do
I
you
kind
really?
Of, yeah. Oh, every. It's the first thing I read. Yes.
Amazing.
It's kind of guilty, but it is a pleasure.
He's such a New Yorker.
Yeah.
All right, well, to close things out, the last thing we always do is we get a cultural recommendation. So it can be something you've seen, something you've heard, something you recommend people go check out when they're done listening to this. So, Hannah, maybe we'll start with you and work our way around.
Okay, cultural recommendation. What was the name of that museum in Detroit?
Oh. Was it just the Detroit Art Museum?
Yeah. The Detroit Art Museum, it's like the Detroit Museum of Arts and Sciences, something like that.
Okay.
In Detroit is so amazing. They've got Diego Rivera murals. They've got armor. They've got beautiful, like, Caravaggio paintings. It's really amazing. And we go to museums all over. And that museum in Detroit is really special. They've got tapestries. It's so cool.
Awesome.
Yeah.
For me, cultural has to be a drive. If you're listening, you happen to go to California and you're in LA, go drive Angeles Crest Highway up to Newcomb's Ranch, continue all the way to Wrightwood, drop down to Pioneer Town, do that drive that goes through Salton Sea, Bombay Beach, Palm Springs. So that's my cultural advice. Go drive Angeles Crest Highway.
Perfect. Ben?
Oh, I do this too.
Yeah, you got to do this too, man.
I wasn't thinking about what I should say. I really enjoyed Friends from College. Have you seen that?
No, I haven't.
No. Is it good?
It is. So it's a Netflix show.
Yeah.
The reason I started watching it is because Fred Savage is in it, who's become like a friend of mine over the past few months.
Yeah.
What was the TV show he was in?
He was on Wonder Years.
Oh, that was
yeah, Kevin Arnold. Good old Kevin Arnold.
There you go.
So I started watching him because I know a guy on the show, and it's really wonderful. It's really funny, and it's basically about a friend group that went to Harvard together, and they're all like, you know, kind of in love with each other, and it's really well done.
Is it better knowing Fred?
Yes, it is. So Fred plays a gay man, and he's amazing. He's really great in it.
Okay,
it's like laugh out loud funny.
Perfect.
Wow. Yeah,
tune in.
Yeah,
awesome. I'm going to recommend another podcast. Actually, there's a new show called The Dropout that's about Theranos, and it's only two episodes in right now. So far, it's really good. They go back and talk to all of Elizabeth Holmes's like professors at Stanford and like her teachers from high school and people she grew up with. And they paint this really crazy picture of how somebody who for a while looked like they were going to be a hero who was going to kind of change the world for the better was actually maybe just kind of a sociopath who was able to fool all of these really brilliant people. It's amazing. So it's only two episodes in and I'm anxiously awaiting more episodes. So I recommend you go check it out.
Cool.
Cool. Well, thank you guys for joining us. It was good to see you.
Great.
I haven't seen
thank you
in a long
guys.
Time, and we'll have to have you back soon.
Yeah.
We'll talk fish and chips.
Perfect.
See you next time.
This week's episode was recorded at Mirrortone Studios in New York City and was produced and edited by Grayson Korhonen. Please remember to subscribe and rate the show. It really does make a difference. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week.